Today is Tuesday, September the 14th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. The World Health Organization has delivered 85 metric tons of life-saving medical supplies to Ethiopia.
This was the largest single shipment of humanitarian cargo to date airlifted by our WHO colleagues at the hub.
And a new government in Lebanon after 13 months of what many say was a leadership vacuum in the country. But critics say that it may take more than a new government to fix the country's economic crisis.
This is a defensive mechanism that will be leveraged by some international aid due to humanitarian crisis hitting Lebanon.
And President Joe Biden sounds off on the impact of climate change while blaming the wildfires engulfing parts of Idaho and other western states on global warming. We have those stories and more coming up right here on International Edition. Stay tuned. And we start off in the U.S., where House Democrats are laying out sweeping plans to boost taxes on big corporations and the wealthy. AP Washington correspondent Saga Megani reports.
It would restore the top tax rate on couples earning more than $450,000 a year to 39.6% and add a 3% tax on Americans making beyond $5 million. Businesses earning more than $5 million would see their top tax rate rise to 26.5%. The hikes are aimed at paying for President Biden's $3.5 trillion rebuilding plan.
We see it as a first step.
Deputy White House spokeswoman Karine Jean-Pierre would not say if the president's willing to lower the plan's cost amid opposition from Republicans and key Democrat Joe Manchin, who says he cannot back $3.5 trillion. Sagar Meghani, Washington.
In California, voters go to the polls Tuesday for a recall vote that pits Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom against leading Republican Larry Elder. And with campaigning down to the wire, allegations are flying. AP correspondent Julie Walker has more.
At a Sunday rally, Newsom told voters take nothing for granted.
If we don't turn out and vote no, Larry Elder is the next governor of the state of California.
Meanwhile, Elder is accusing the media of a double standard that insulates Newsom from criticism and scrutiny.
This is a double standard to which I've been subjected to my entire time, and I'm sick of it.
He held a Sunday news conference with activist Rose McGowan.
Do I agree with him on all points? No. So what? He is the better candidate. He is the better man.
The actress repeated her claims that Newsom's wife tried to get her not to go public with sexual misconduct allegations against Hollywood producer Harvey Weinstein. In an AP interview, Newsom hit back.
They are doing a last-minute classic hit piece.
I'm Julie Walker.
President Joe Biden sounded the alarm on climate change during a trip to Idaho on Monday, his first stop on a three-state western U.S. tour, where he pledged support for higher wages for firefighters and more resources to fight wildfires. As he heads west, President Biden is looking to leave a tough month behind. AP Washington correspondent Saga Megani has more.
From the chaotic Afghan withdrawal to a surging coronavirus, the past several weeks have been difficult, and the nation's let the president know. His personal approval numbers are down, but he says the country backs his agenda, including the $3.5 trillion infrastructure plan.
My package is overwhelmingly popular.
The president says that will lead to the GOP going after him, not his policies.
A lot more direct attacks on me, not what I'm for. And that's I'm a big boy.
But he's also facing Democratic opposition in a Senate where he has no votes to spare. Joe Manchin says he cannot back the infrastructure plan's price tag and says there's no way Congress will pass it this month. Sagar Meghani, Washington.
You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. The World Health Organization Logistics Hub in Dubai delivered 85 metric tons of medical supplies to Ethiopia. That is according to the UN spokesperson, Stefan Dujarric. The conflict in the Tigray region and a drought are some of the factors pushing hundreds of thousands into a food crisis.
The World Health Organization's Logistics Hub in Dubai has now delivered 85 metric tons of life-saving medical supplies to Ethiopia. This was the largest single shipment of humanitarian cargo to date airlifted by our WHO colleagues at the hub. The supplies includes medicines, trauma and emergency surgery kits, consumables, equipment, cholera kits. We're flown by charter donated by the United Arab Emirates, to whom we are grateful, and that landed in Addis Ababa, and it will address the urgent needs of more than 150,000 people.
That was UN spokesperson Stéphane Dujarric. And preliminary findings of a joint investigation by the UN Human Rights Office and the Ethiopian Human Rights Commission into alleged violation of human rights and other abuse in the conflict-ridden Tigray region will be presented to the UN Human Rights Council. From Geneva, Lisa Schlein has more.
Since the last update in June, fighting has continued unabated in Tigray and has expanded into neighboring Afar and Amhara regions. Human Rights Chief Bachelet says mass detentions, killings, systematic looting, and sexual violence have displaced nearly 2 million people in this region and has created an atmosphere of fear. She says civilian suffering is widespread and impunity is pervasive. Bachelet says investigators have documented multiple allegations of human rights violations, including extrajudicial killings, torture, and enforced disappearances. She says sexual and gender-based violence, including gang rapes, have been characterized by a pattern of extreme brutality and ethnically targeted.
From my last update to the Council to date, allegations of human rights violations have continued to implicate government forces and its allies. We have received disturbing reports that local fishermen found dozens of bodies floating along the river crossing between Western Tigray and Sudan in July. Some allegedly had gunshot wounds and bound hands, indications that they might have been detained and tortured before being killed.
The Ethiopian government declared a unilateral ceasefire in Tigray at the end of June, nearly 8 months after it began its military offensive in the region. Shortly after, Tigrayan rebels retook the capital, Mekele. Bachelet reports Tigrayan forces have perpetrated many human rights abuses since gaining control of parts of Tigray and expanding to neighboring regions.
During the period under review, the Tigrayan forces have allegedly been responsible for attacks on civilians, including indiscriminate killings resulting in nearly 76,500 people displaced in Afar and an estimated 200,000 in Amhara. More than 200 individuals have reportedly been killed in the most recent clashes in these regions, and 88 individuals, including children, have been injured.
Bachelet says accountability for human rights abuses and a national reconciliation process are the only solution to the conflict in Tigray and to achieving a sustainable peace. The chief of the Ethiopian Human Rights Commission, Danielle Bekele, says all parties to the conflict have committed violence against civilians, including sexual violence and use of child soldiers. But he notes the situation in Tigray is complex. He says the commission is still analyzing the information and evidence gathered and is not ready to share any findings and conclusions at this stage. He says the commission's findings, conclusions, and recommendations will be contained in the final report of the joint investigation to be published November 1st. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
North Korea has conducted its first missile test in about 6 months. The long-range cruise missile that was launched could give North Korea another way to invade its neighbor's missile defenses, as VOA's Bill Gallo reports from Seoul.
North Korea says it tested newly developed long-range cruise missiles Saturday and Sunday. South Korea, which usually tracks and reports North Korean launches shortly after they occur, didn't comment until Monday. That raises questions about whether the U.S. and South Korea detected the missile test. At a briefing, a South Korean military spokesman said that Seoul is working closely with Washington to conduct an in-depth analysis of the launch. Cruise missiles fly at relatively low altitudes and can be guided in flight. That allows them to fly under or around missile defense radars. Analysts say the missile appeared visually similar to the U.S. Tomahawk, a nuclear-capable cruise missile with a range of about 1,600 kilometers. North Korea hinted its missile is nuclear-capable, though it's not clear the North yet has a nuclear warhead small enough to fit on it. Regardless, the missile is another lethal component in North Korea's arsenal, which has significantly expanded since 2019, when it resumed major weapons tests. United Nations Security Council resolutions ban North Korea from activity involving ballistic missiles, which potentially fly further than cruise missiles. By testing cruise missiles, which the resolutions do not ban, analysts say North Korea appears to be testing how far it can go without provoking a major U.S. response.
10월 10일 당 창건일 전후로 무력시 가능성 배제
Seoul-based analyst Yang Woo-jin says he expects North Korea to conduct additional demonstrations of military power in the coming weeks. But he says he doesn't expect any major provocations that would violate UN sanctions. North Korea is frustrated the U.S. did not relax sanctions during 2 years of talks in 2018 and 2019. With those talks stalled, North Korea seems set on expanding its weapons program. The North hasn't conducted an intercontinental ballistic missile or nuclear test since 2017. Many analysts suspect North Korea won't take any step that risks bringing further economic and diplomatic isolation. For the past year and a half, North Korea has imposed one of the world's strictest pandemic lockdowns, leaving its economy devastated. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
A new government was announced in Lebanon this week after 13 months of what many say was a leadership vacuum in the country. However, today, critics warn that the new government might not be the solution to the country's multifaceted economic crisis. George Eid reports for VOA from Beirut.
Lebanese President Michel Aoun announced this week the formation of a new government. This comes after 13 months of continuous efforts to form a cabinet. The country has since been in the hands of a caretaker government. The Prime Minister, Najib Mikati, who was the third person to try to form a government since last year, has succeeded only after a few weeks of wrangling over the distribution of the cabinet ministries between the Lebanese political parties. Analysts agree that international pressure was one of the main reasons the new government saw the light. A U.S. congressional delegation led by Senator Chris Murphy had visited Lebanon and met the Lebanese president and other Lebanese political leaders. Local journalist Rana Risha told VOA that the U.S. and France have pushed forward for the formation of a new government in Lebanon.
I truly believe the U.S. and France played a major role in putting pressure on the process of forming a government. It is no coincidence that the government was born days after a congressional delegation visited Lebanon a few days ago. They actually voiced out the need for a new government, and the local media reported that they have stressed on the matter in a clear way during their meeting with the Lebanese president. France, on the other hand, and President Macron played a role since day one by making sure the regional powers that control the Lebanese parties collaborate for the formation of a new government. It was announced that French President Emmanuel Macron called the Iranian president to facilitate the birth of a new government in Lebanon through the militia group he backs, Hezbollah. On another note, the government itself does not represent the best people Lebanon has to offer. But then again, if it succeeds to organize the upcoming parliamentary election, we can hope for a change.
The new Lebanese government that includes 23 ministers features only one woman as a Minister of State for Administrative Development Affairs. It was perceived by some as not adequate, while others welcomed the long-awaited move of forming a new government. Independent Lebanese political activist Mark Dow explained to VOA that the new government is an attempt to save the current political regime in Lebanon that was falling apart.
I believe this government in particular has been created to try and defend the regime from falling apart. The regime of the major political parties that are in control and risk being held accountable for all the disasters that have struck Lebanon. So this is a government aimed at attempting to undermine accountability processes and enforcing a transition in governance, whether through the formation of this government or the upcoming parliamentary elections and the upcoming election of a new president next year. The idea is to try to defend the regime and recycle old politicians into similar places and undermine public unrest and the loss of credibility that has been caused by all the crises in the country. So therefore, this is a defensive mechanism that will be leveraged by some international aid due to humanitarian crises hitting Lebanon. They will try to manipulate that aid. But I think the most dangerous thing about this government is that this government might try to align Lebanon even closer to the Iranian axis and the Syrian regime. And there might be a serious attempt at solidifying a hold or a grip for the Syrian regime as well as the Iranian regime over Lebanon and enforcing that as a de facto state within their axis of influence.
Lebanese lira surged to 15,600 to the dollar upon the announcement of a new government after it had plummeted as low as 22,000 in recent weeks. The new Lebanese government is expected to deal with long-awaited reforms in a country suffering a major economic meltdown. This is George Aid reporting for VOA from Beirut.
And in more headline news, the White House says that the United States is prepared to engage with North Korea despite the country's announcement that it had tested a new long-range cruise missile over the weekend. And the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention on Monday warned against travel to Afghanistan, Albania, Serbia, Belize, Lithuania, and four other destinations because of COVID-19 concerns. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. The UN Human Rights Council has begun its annual session in Geneva, and in an opening address Monday, UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, warned that climate change and pollution pose grave threats to human rights and humanity itself. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The UN rights chief says human inaction in the face of planetary disasters is having a severe impact on a broad range of rights, including the rights to adequate food, water, education, health, and even life itself. Michelle Bachelet says extreme and murderous climate events have been unleashed on people in every region in recent months.
Monumental fires in Siberia and California, huge sudden floods in China, Germany, and Turkey, Arctic heat waves leading to unprecedented methane emissions, and the persistence of interminable droughts from Morocco and Senegal to Siberia, potentially forcing millions of people into misery, hunger, and displacement.
Bachelet warns intensifying environmental threats constitute the single greatest challenge to human rights. She says environmental disasters amplify conflicts, tensions, increase vulnerabilities, and structural inequalities around the world. For example, she notes the humanitarian emergency in Africa's Sahel countries is being fueled by climate change. She says long droughts followed by flash floods, unequal access to natural resources, and high rates of youth unemployment are plaguing the region.
These trends compel people to displacement, aggravate conflicts and political instability, and fuel recruitment by violent extremist groups. In such a situation, it should be clear that there can be no purely military solution to the conflicts in the region. To date, 4 million people across the Sahel have been displaced, according to UNHCR estimates.
Bachelet says similar trends and challenges exist in different forms and to varying degrees in all regions of the world. For example, Asia, the Middle East, and North Africa are gripped by water shortages, causing tensions to rise over this scarce resource. She reports climate change is having a striking impact on poverty, displacement, and fundamental human rights in Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras. She says environmental and human rights defenders are being threatened, harassed, and even killed, often with complete impunity, in Latin America, Southeast Asia, and other regions. The UN rights chief says a safe, clean, healthy, and sustainable environment is the foundation of human life. She adds, the future of humanity depends on governments acting to preserve the world's precious resources. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. Research shows that the African continent has the highest number of women entrepreneurs in the world, many of them starting small to medium businesses each year to overcome poverty while building a better future for their families and subsequently their communities. However, development experts warn that even though there has been considerable progress in the last decade, as conditions improve and more women entrepreneurs enter the marketplace, a combination of socioeconomic factors still hinder their advancement. Amit Dah, an economist with the World Bank, says that countries need to address some of the persistent gender gaps and inequalities that contribute to women earning lower profits than men.
It becomes even more important in COVID times because the COVID crisis is hitting women particularly hard because a lot of them were sort of these informal sector traders at the margins, and they are hit even harder because their small businesses are gone now, or closed. So we really need to just make sure that we redouble our efforts on women and girls. And I know it's not going to be easy, given countries have less resources right now. But at the same time, there's a lot that needs to be done and can be done. And putting money in this area is going to reap huge dividends in the future.
Right. And you say there's a lot that can be done.
Yes.
Be done. So what are some of the barriers that impede women's participation in business or in economic development? Are they mainly social? Are they mainly cultural? Some of them even codified in too low in some societies.
Yes, yes. I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head. It's a combination of all of these things. So, which is basically some laws, for example, which prevent pregnant girls from going to school. You need to put in laws which provide stronger legal protection against gender-based violence for women and children. So those are some of the things that really do need to sort of are barriers in some sense, which impact or go against stronger women and children and girls' participation in schooling, in the labor market, and so which inhibit women from doing or reaching up to their full potential.
Okay, now
I think that those are the types of things we should be working on,
as well as
investing in education and health opportunities which allow girls to go to school. And we've seen numerous examples from around the world that when those opportunities are open and available, girls do fantastically. The economy does very well.
Right.
So
right.
Those are the types of things we need to do. Sorry.
Right. And you're right. Many studies have shown that some of the ways to empower women or girls is through education. However, we've seen around the continent, whether it's in sub-Saharan Africa or other parts of the developing world, that in many there are these persistent cultural attitudes that continue to impede girls' education. How does that change in the next 20 years as we are pursuing the sustainable development goals?
Excellent question, and not an easy answer, but I think it's a combination of several things. One is sort of a lot of communication around the importance of investing in girls and girls' education, investing in women, and showing that this reaps significant benefits for society and for the economy. That's number one, I think. Number two is to actually get the community leaders and community elders very much involved. It can be a message from the top, of course, which will be very important, but you really need the communities to actually buy into this message and to sort of getting them involved. Once you have your community leader saying that, yes, I need to make sure that girls in this village are going to school, it changes the whole dynamic. So, having dialogue with them and actually getting them to be your champions is going to be the most important thing. So we've seen, for example, in Bangladesh, that is what they did in the early 90s, where they got the religious leaders very much involved in supporting girls' education. And in a matter of one generation, the whole system changed. There was the girls' enrollment rate doubled in one generation. These girls who then became women joined the labor market, started working. Bangladesh had this big garment industry. So all of that, it changed the whole structure of the economy, and it really changed also the dynamics at the household level, with women having greater say in what was happening in the household because they also had economic power. And it was a really, for Bangladesh, that has been one of the most significant changes that has helped improve the
economy.
And you
see that, and you see that type of model also working in sub-Saharan Africa.
It very much could work in sub-Saharan Africa. We are doing some very innovative things with governments in the Sahel through our women's empowerment and demographic dividend programs, where we are basically working with them from sort of at early ages in terms of maternal and child health, trying to get girls into school, and then giving them access to employment opportunities. But always sort of making sure that, you know, the community is very well involved in the decision making and taking the lead in that. Because I think once that also happens, it changes the dynamic very quickly. And I think we'll see within a generation or less, actually significant changes happening because of some of those types of interventions.
That was Amit Dah, an economist with the World Bank. I reached him at the World Bank headquarters here in Washington, D.C. And let's go to West Africa in Benin, where early in the COVID-19 pandemic, Benin set up a service to allow people to register their businesses online. The e-registration system has worked so well that this West African country is now the world's fastest place to start a business, that is according to a UN agency. Moki Edwin Kinzeka narrates this report by Anne Nzuanku in Cotonou, Benin.
Sandra Edusu is the owner of a store selling art in Cotonou, Benin. She submitted her business application online and received approval and legal documents within 3 hours. She says if there was not this facility to create a business online, if one had to go stand in line, wait in line, go through the maze of administration to start a business, she wouldn't have done it. It's as simple as that, she says. She would have stayed in the informal sector. To create her business, Sandra went online to monentepis.bj, a platform in Benin, to create and formally start a business. The site was launched in February 2020 by the country's Investment and Export Promotion Agency. It was the start of the pandemic, and the agency did not want people to come into their offices. Applicants fill out the required information, download the required documents, and make a payment online. The documents arrive at the agency's headquarters, where staff verify the information and mail business certificates to those who are approved. Laurent Gambis, the general manager of the Investment and Export Promotion Agency, says in 2019, the agency was at 28,000 businesses created. And in 2020, the figure went to over 41,000 businesses created. He adds, for him, this has been a good performance. It shows to the agency that the platform has been accepted and today it processes an application in 3 hours. The online service helped make Benin the fastest place in the world to start a company, according to the UN Conference on Trade and Development. The businesses must be located in Benin. However, people abroad can use the service if they are in the process of setting up a business inside the country. Economists like Albert Holunku see big benefits for entrepreneurs. He says the online service reduces costs, it reduces delays, and it avoids corruption. It also avoids carrying papers around. And in the COVID period, it avoids contacts and also avoids the lengthening of delays. The Investment and Export Promotion Agency says it will continue to review the procedures and dialogue with the private sector to further improve the process. For Anne Zwanke in Cotonou, Benin, Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Jackson Vunganya in Washington. Be well, be safe, have a great week ahead.